I'm Christopher Lydon with the global spirit Pico Iyer, a man with big links to India, England, America, Japan in his head and his heart. He finds himself now channeling the novelist Graham Greene, a sort of patron saint of the foreigner alone out there in famous books and movies like The Quiet American and Our Man in Havana. What does it mean, as Pico Iyer writes of Graham Greene, to have a man inside his head? This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. And Pico Iyer is our wildest dream, a writer who can find the center of the world anywhere. Pico Iyer, so good to see you. I'm wondering, a little skeptically, has the world spirit faltered since I've seen you? We spoke in 2009 of Barack Obama as the global soul in the White House. It seems a long time ago, this notion of the United States as the nation of nations and himself as the leader of a truly transnational country. Are we still headed that way, in the Pico direction?
It's really nice to be talking to you again, Chris. And I think the world is moving ever more towards transnationalism. Our country, especially its youth, is getting more international. If you or I were to walk into a classroom, high school or university, tomorrow, I think it would be more diverse than it was 2.5 years ago when I saw you. And we still do have that rare, unexpected blessing of the finest travel writer in America being the president of the nation, which may never happen again. You know, if only Melville or Annie Dillard or Emerson had been president, just think where we might have been. So the world is cyclical. And living in Japan, you get to feel that progress has less to do with always pushing forwards, perhaps in the American way, as with coming back again and again. Spring leads to autumn, leads to spring again. So I think the world's spirit is as vibrant as ever it was, although, of course, it's taken some huge setbacks since I last saw you. But I'm not I think the spirit can take care of itself. It's the externals that shift.
You're quoting Emerson. Emerson, at the end of that Montaigne essay, says, you know, rogues win every election. The news is a series of defeats, but the world's spirit is a strong swimmer. And he goes on that it will not be defeated. But come back. This is the first week of February 2012. We may be on the verge of an American-supported attack on Iran. I worry desperately that we have retreated, that Dick Cheney is still president, that we've retreated from a vision of talking with everybody.
Well, if politics is the art of the possible, it's also the fact of the constant disappointment. I mean, that we're always going to be, the more promising our leaders are, probably the more disappointed we're going to be in them. And you're right, the political landscape doesn't change very much. But the human landscape doesn't change very much either. But I think it's so easy to see the things that haven't changed, that we miss the subtler things that are changing all around us. So
count the ways.
So every day, more Chinese, Vietnamese, Iranians, and Guatemalans arriving in our country, re-importing the American dream, bringing back a sense of possibility to our shores. Whatever happens to Barack Obama, the man, and however much he's disappointed his supporters, Barack Obama, the symbol, has changed the course of the world. And it's still a fact that in Britain, France, many of the countries I know, Obama is many years away from being elected. America is still leading the globe in possibility just by virtue of having chosen him. In terms of our hostility towards Iran and Iran's hostility towards us, every nation tries to stir its populace by finding a convenient enemy. I'm finally going to go to Iran the day that my current book tour ends.
Really? What are you looking for? Who are you going to see? What do you expect?
I'm not looking to see anybody, but I just want to recover the forgotten Persia. I want to retrieve a sense of the cultural and spiritual past of that great culture, which is so often effaced by the headlines. So since I was a little boy, I've been fascinated by the poems and the paintings and the carpets, the aesthetic of Persia. And I wrote a whole novel 8 or 9 years ago about Prussia in America and around the world. And I concluded it with a vivid 40-page description of driving across Iran, but I've never set foot there. So I'm, among other things, interested to see how the reality corresponds with my imagination. But I'm deliberately not seeking people out. I'm not going to spend much time in Tehran. It's almost a way to remind myself and anybody who reads the article that comes out of it that Persia is still Mashhad and Qom and Shiraz and Persepolis and Isfahan. And to remind maybe the Persians and Iranians I meet that a typical American today is somebody like me, small, dark-skinned, interested in Islam, and sufficiently interested in their culture to travel 6,000 miles to see it and learn about it.
Oh, man, I want you to give us the course. Part of that question is just informed by a month we spent in Pakistan last summer, and the whole mission was not to talk geostrategy or seek out generals or even journalists, but novelists, painters, historians, musicians above all, perhaps. I want to know how you prepare for, you know, what we call parachute radio into Iran. What do you read?
I've been reading Vita Sackville-West, her story of going to Tehran, I think in the 1920s. Trying to read obliquely in that sense. There have been a few recent accounts. I read a surprisingly beautiful book recently called Saved by Beauty by an Englishman in California who, again, went there relatively recently in search of Rumi and Hafez and the passionate laureates of possibility and spirit, the Emersons of Persia. And as you know, I think Emerson adored Hafez. And then that's a whole side to the culture that we forget. And just as you were saying about Pakistan, my experience as a traveler is that the more hostile any government is to ours, the more responsive its people are to Americans and the more eager they are to make contact with us, if only because they are the first and foremost victims of their government. Mm-hmm. And so the one thing I've heard about Iran is that its people are almost smotheringly friendly towards foreigners, and also I know extremely articulate and cultured. So I think the reason I'm going to Iran is really to rescue our idea of Iran and remember that it's not just its government, but all those people who are suffering under their government. And in my head, I want to rescue the people of Iran and their faces and voices and realities from an Iran that so far, to me, is only associated often with the government.
Pico, I have come back to Graham Greene, the man inside your head, a man we all sort of know, and it's wonderful to be reminded of the intensity of that writing and the observation all through it. But it would have seemed to me in many ways he is the opposite of you. He lived in an entirely different world that you just described where more and more Chinese, Indians, Indonesians, you name it, arriving on our shores. He was a student of the shadows of foreignness and the people on the margins. There are no margins anymore. And there's no margins in Pico world. There's that wonderful line I think you quote where he encounters an Indian, or maybe it was a German, but in Mexico, just one of those outliers. And he spoke of the man as a symbol of the shabby, the inefficient, and possibly the illegal. Nowadays, we confront nothing but the rampant, the technologically proficient, if not visionary, the empowered, the connected. The world has so changed since Graham Greene. Describe what that old voice is doing in your head.
The first thing I think of is that in my favorite book of his, The Quiet American, which, as you know, was both set and written in Saigon in the early 1950s, initially, he writes about napalm bombing, CIA intrigue, American operatives trying to make contact with Vietnamese allies 10 years before that even began to happen.
Astonishing. No, it's still I try to read it at least once every 5 years just to be reminded. That whole insight of God save us from the innocent and the good. Go on.
And also, beyond that and beyond getting the particulars of the world around him, as he did so well, I always feel he's catching some much deeper allegorical current or pattern that doesn't change so much. Initially, I see him as, I think you described him, as the poet laureate of the foreigner abroad. That his books are all about what happens when you, Chris, walk down the street in Islamabad and a stranger comes up to you with a hand extended. What do you do with that? You know all the things you shouldn't do. You know what the right thing is. But how do you address that? And of course, you're confronted with that here in Boston all the time, but at home, it's easy for us to sleepwalk past that, whereas foreignness intensifies and distills these moral and emotional challenges. But the deeper thing, and your question goes right to the core of this, is that, as you remember, in The Quiet American, it's about a middle-aged Englishman who claims to have no feelings and opinions, a young, dangerously idealistic American just out of Harvard Yard, determined to save the world by destroying it, and the Vietnamese woman who shimmers between them and always seems to remain outside their grasp. So I really tell my friends, if at a deep level you want to know what's going to happen in Afghanistan next year or what just happened in Iraq, read The Quiet American. And just the story of America going around the world with very pure intentions, but not always with a discernment of the realities of the place they're visiting, he got that to perfection in that book. And he caught something that we just see playing out again and again. The location changes, but the emotional situation doesn't.
But of course, you know that the intentions are not pure. We're deep now into a kind of repetition compulsion syndrome. We don't learn from Vietnam. He saw it 10 years ahead. 50 years later, you know, we keep doing it. What's wrong, Pico?
The famous Santayana line, those who don't remember history are condemned to repeat it, and maybe we're not thinking enough about history, that we live in a tabula rasa culture. Every year is the beginning of a new thing, and so, as you said, we repeat the same mistakes over and over. Europe may do that to some degree, but it does have a sense of where it's lost and blundered in the past, and it has the wounds to show it. It's interesting, if you walk down the street in Hanoi today, the pirated book that all the little kids are trying to sell you as soon as you step out of your hotel is The Quiet American, and I think they seem to realize that the best foreign account of their country in the year 2011 is The Quiet American, published in 1955. And of course, that's what a writer is trying to do, which is to see beneath the constant revolving door of change to what doesn't change. And therefore, by reading the past closely enough, reading the future. And I think he did that to a surpassing degree.
No question, but I just wonder, what is the block in our heads that keeps us from understanding that, from changing some direction pretty fundamentally?
Well, my prejudice, as expressed in this book, The Man Within My Head, is that in England, where I grew up, we were taught very closely to read and to attend to the world by ignoring ourselves. And in America, and Emerson and Thoreau are the great apostles of this, there's a great commitment to understanding the self, but it sometimes comes with an ignorance towards the world. I like Graham Greene because I feel he looked at the difficult parts of himself and the difficult parts of the world. But I think when it comes to foreign policy, there is a wisdom in the older cultures of the world that our culture, precisely because of its freshness and youth, doesn't necessarily have. On the other hand, our culture has all those individual benefits exemplified by Emerson and Thoreau that nowhere else has. And that's why immigrants like me are streaming in to America to make the American dream real in our individual souls. I think America is the country of the soul, maybe. And these other places are much more comfortable within the Machiavellian world of geopolitics.
You write beautifully in this book, Pico, early on, about Graham Greene in school. His peers at Berkhamsted were learning strength and how to go out and administer empire. This is in the 19-teens and 20s. The empire already in its first stages of dissolution. Greene, meanwhile, was learning just the opposite, how to take power apart, how to do justice to its victims, and so on. Where's our Graham Greene? Where is the American writer of the grand scale who is, as you said about Graham Greene, he was an Englishman in flight from Englishness. Where are the American writers in flight from American exceptionalism, from all this kind of self-deception and illusion and catastrophe? Is it you, maybe?
It's not I, but people like me may represent the second half of my answer to your question. I mean, the names that instantly come to my head are Don DeLillo, Robert Stone, Thomas Pynchon, perhaps.
Yes.
Robert Stone is almost a direct heir to the Greenian legacy, a troubled Catholic who goes to the war zones of the world to see the soul in peril in all senses, but also to see what America is up to in these shadowy corners. So I think we've got a few really distinguished novelists to take care of all that, the way that the Mailers and others of the world did before. But the other thing which your addition touched upon is that American literature is currently being written and rewritten by the latest newcomers from Russia, the Dominican Republic, Haiti, Cuba, Korea. That if you're looking at, let's say, the New Yorker selection of the best writers under 40, they mostly have names we can't pronounce, like Chimamanda Adichie and Gary Steingart and Juno Diaz and Jhumpa Lahiri and Yiyun Lee and many, many others. And what they're doing, among other things, is, well, they're remaking America and then creating an America that is full of people from those other countries. But I think they're also importing the wisdom of their ancestral homes and making new combinations. So that's all promising. I mean, I think the American soul is taking on new colors now, and our president is another example of that. If nothing else, however you feel about Obama, I would say that we've never had a president who understands life in Indonesia, as he does. We've never had a president who knows the complications of interacting with Kenya, and therefore with many another impoverished nation, at least on the human level, as he does. And he hasn't always managed to translate that into policy, but it's certainly a step forwards, because in terms of global understanding is the currency of the moment, and he does have that.
I just want to hear more of that piece of the man whose grandfather was abused by Brits, and who, a man who grew up knowing that those stories. To me, his greatest moment was in the 2008 campaign, saying hello in Berlin, and he said, "I greet you as proud citizen of the United States, fellow citizen of the world." But that man is sort of in hiding, or maybe he's forced into hiding by Romney think, Gingrich think. What is it?
Maybe he's in prison. That man is imprisoned within the role, within the system, within all of it. He's a citizen of the world in a country that's not yet necessarily a citizen of the world. And as you know, my great sorrow living in this country is that I'm living in one of the most isolated nations and one that has chosen not really fully to be part of the global neighborhood, even as the globe is streaming into our shores. And I spend a lot of time in Canada because I'm interested in how another North American nation can have such an advanced global consciousness, I would say the most enlightened and far-seeing on the planet, coming out of very similar circumstances to our own, but it's just a change of attitude. They've decided not only to bring the world into their shores, but to go out and see what the world looks and tastes like. Everywhere I go in my travels, I'll meet somebody who sounds American, and I'll ask them, "Are you from Toronto or Vancouver?" And so Canada, to me, represents some of the potential that this country has but isn't using yet. But, of course, Canada has advantages over this nation by being smaller, less encumbered with power and self-consciousness, more mobile in that sense.
Last time I saw you, Pico, speaking of these writers, we were talking about Zadie Smith as the kind of the queen of the May, and this child of Jamaica, of England, living much of the time in New York, the novel White Teeth, embodying everything we're talking about. Who's leading that wave today, do you think?
Well, I've got to admit, Chris, that the best book that I've read since I saw you 2.5 years ago was Zadie Smith's book of essays, Changing My Mind, which came out 6 months after our conversation.
Wow.
And we were extolling her then, but that book just blew me away. I'm going to the University of Iowa, the great cathedral of writing, 2 weeks from now, and they asked me to take a text that I could share with the students and discuss. And the only one I could think of instantly was Zadie Smith, and particularly her essay that came out a few months after we spoke about herself, Obama, and Shakespeare, a hymn to people with many voices and selves inside themselves.
Well, that's the best piece written on Obama for sure to this day. And you can hear it on the Public Library on the Public Library podcast from New York, too. Extraordinary.
Extraordinary. And to how many writers can weave together a personal testament and a study of our political leader and literary criticism all in the same thing, and actually expand each one of her three subjects by looking at the other. So she's ever more an exhilarating talent and drawing from all the different voices and selves inside her. And it's interesting when you were describing how she's half Jamaican and grew up in England and now is largely in New York, I was thinking of Malcolm Gladwell, another interesting visionary who half Jamaican, grew up, was born in England, spent a lot of his formative years in Canada, is now in New York. And in some ways, there are a lot of these interesting mongrels who probably, one way or another, because of those different selves inside them, are creating new combinations that would be difficult for you or me to claim.
You've spoken so beautifully about the center of the literary universe can be anywhere now, whether it's Istanbul if you're reading Orhan Pamuk. But this is the world that Emerson described as a circle. And he quoted St. Augustine describing God. I'm sure you know that essay, Circles, God as the model, whose center is everywhere, whose circumference is nowhere. Where are the other centers that you're watching these days, this mobile center of our consciousness?
Boring to say, but for many, many years, I've horrified the citizens of Toronto by telling them that they seem to be in the lead in terms of the mingling of cultures, in terms of the anticipation of the future, in terms of constructing a society that's open and accommodating to all of that. People would tell me about Scandinavia and Australia, New Zealand, the New Zealand's rather small, but these other places that have the benefit of the English language and certain of the things, the better things that Britain brought them, but also have an agility that Britain and the US don't have. But I think Toronto is the leading world city and kind of a model of what others of us could form. And I've been interested in places like Singapore for the same reason, and Sydney may be moving in that direction. But yes, there are new centers coming up all the time. Not long ago, I went to Shanghai, and I went to Hyderabad, and I went to Dubai. And I don't know that we have anything to fear, as it were, or to hope for from those. In Hyderabad, I arrived at the gleaming new airport to find free internet terminals everywhere, and I was told you can use them as long as you pay. I stepped into a prepaid taxi, and it wasn't prepaid, and it wasn't a taxi. It was a rickety, broken car driven by two teenagers who didn't know how to go where they were going. We got into this glorious new expressway, no signs and no lights. So the infrastructure in India, despite all the individual talent, is still suffering. Dubai is Las Vegas with Arab trappings, but I don't know that it's really going to be a model for anybody. And of course, as you were suggesting before, it's collapsed in recent years due to the recession. And Shanghai is a bedazzlement. And I was there 18 months ago during the expo, and I arrived happily at dusk, got into the fastest train in the world to take me halfway into the city, got into a taxi, was driving on these overpasses, blue-lit overpasses with 7,000 skyscrapers, each one done up in a different color, and I really felt as if I'd arrived in the year 2046. I've never seen such a stunning display. Woke up the next morning, the sky was black. And people said, oh, you're so lucky to be here on a sunny day because of the pollution. And in other words, the cost of that development is that it's almost unlivable. But as a showcase, it's spectacular. And Louis Vuitton stores in the shape of suitcases and fabulous Potemkin places, the likes of which is hard to even imagine elsewhere. And yet the reality is a difficult and not so pleasant one often. Mm. So I think a lot of the northern European places and places like Toronto and maybe Vancouver still have considerable advantages.
Mm. I wonder, in a China century, in a world where the power, the people, the interest runs sort of from Jakarta to Cairo, for you, Pico Iyer, a child of the West after all, what is at risk in a world where New York and London are not the first authorities? What are we going to miss? Or what in fact will we lose in the new world?
I don't think we're going to lose much at all. My very first book, which I wrote in 1985, I said, well, sadly, the American century is already over. The Asian century has begun. And I'm not being just flip or facetious when I say for many years when I come back to this country, it's a bit of, from wherever I've been, it's a bit of a shock to the system because it seems so far behind in terms of consciousness and global awareness, as we were talking before, but just behind in terms of its facilities. It's ahead of Hyderabad, but Los Angeles or New York or many of our major cities seem like third world places if you're just coming from Hong Kong or Zurich or Tokyo, for sure. Less ingenious, less developed, slower, more chaotic. Last year, I ended up both in downtown Dallas and downtown Newark, and you can imagine how they compare with some of these cities. But even our most modern cities seem rickety by comparison with especially the cities of Asia. Singapore is another gleaming example. So I think Americans are maybe the only people in the world who don't realize how far our country has fallen behind. And it's taking us a long time to wake up to the realization, because if we don't travel, we're like people living in a hovel, assuming everyone's in a worse hovel. If we step out of our hovel, we'll see everybody else is living in gleaming high-rises far ahead of us. When I fly from Los Angeles to Hong Kong, say, and get out of the plane, and within 30 minutes, all that strikes me is energy, movement. This is a place pulsing towards the future for all the drawbacks I was describing regarding Shanghai a minute ago. So I think the center of gravity shifted a long, long time ago. Many of the great thinkers and visionaries are still coming to this country because it's regarded, it's still America, the notion still has a power that America, the nation, may have squandered. But I think many of them are going to places like Vancouver and Toronto.
And there's an expressiveness, let's be real, there's a freedom, there's an entitlement, there's an encouragement in this culture that we don't find elsewhere or everywhere. But I do wonder, and I wonder especially in terms of media, who is going to tell the Americans? We know everything. We see everything on Facebook or video. We have free access to all the images, the truth that you're describing. What's going to wake us up? I always wanted the New York Times to announce the fact that, no, Saddam did not have anything to do with 9/11. Get that 70% belief. Just banish it. Mm. I always said, you know, if 70% of the people believed that Martha Stewart was the Yankees shortstop, the New York Times would have run a correction on the front page. No, not so. But nobody seems to want to step up and say, hello, America. You know, Gingrich world is flatly untrue.
Well, ignorance has been replaced by the illusion of knowledge. And you're absolutely right. All those statistics famously, like in the movie Waiting for Superman, about education around the world, the U.S. features near the bottom in the charts in terms of achievement, and it always features number one in terms of self-confidence, that we believe we have the best system. In fact, we're number 30, and that's one of the most dangerous gaps that we could have between perception and reality. I mean, we're in Plato's cave more than anyone else. But I think the globe, as I see it, is like many a classroom here, which is America is slightly out of it and off in the corner staring at the wall, and everybody else is busy working and planning their summer jobs and moving ahead. So I don't think countries like China or India or parts of the Islamic world are so concerned about America. They're busy crafting their future, and if America misses out on it, too bad, that's our loss.
Come back to Graham Greene and the man inside your head. I think a lot of readers, including me, will respond by saying, wait a sec, who's the man inside my head? How does this work that these people we've never met, and you never did meet him, came close, but how do these people we've never met so inhabit us and inform us, and who's mine? You remind me of Harold Bloom talking about period of depression in his 30s when he read all of the Emerson notebooks. I mean, this is years of reading for most people. He's the fastest reader in the world. But the point was, he said he discovered a man speaking directly to him, not only the American God, as he has called Emerson, but the God within, the voice inside his own ear. But how do we figure that out? I still want to know who's mine. Might be you.
I think Emerson might be yours too. Graham Greene is not the God within, but the fallen man within me. But I love the fact that the very title may move people to think about who it is within them who most inhabits them. And I think it won't take most people a long time to come up with some answers, because all of us have some actor, some artist, some writer, some singer, even some figure from history who we do feel knows us more intimately and better than our own friends and family do, and who, as you say, become shadow siblings or ghost parents to us. And when I was thinking about it, it's lovely that you mentioned Emerson. The first, if my friends were here, they would say, oh, the man inside Pico's head is Emerson or Thoreau. And they'd be right. Those people are very close to my heart and close to my soul. And I've begun four of my books with epigraphs from Thoreau. And I'm always, you know, they are my talismans since childhood. But in some ways, Emerson and Thoreau, and this is, as you said before, the other side of America, they speak to me for affirmation, possibility. They speak to that side of me that believes that I can be more than I imagine, that the world can be better than it is, that we all have untapped resources within us. They are the American religion, as Harold Bloom put it so wonderfully. They are the gospel of human potential. So I've written a lot about them. All I do, it seems, is read them again and again, think about them. But in order to give that vision, hardcore reality, you have to look at the people who remind you of your darker spots and the ones that you don't want to look at, and your brokenness and fallenness and incapacities. And so that's where I enlist Graham Greene. Typically, as an Englishman, he's not concerned with possibility. He's concerned with reality and the things that we fail to do and the ways that we never live up to our notions. And so I thought, for me at least, it would be a tonic thing to summon this ghost who pushes me against the wall and forces me to look at those parts of myself that are very contradictory or shadowy or flawed, at least as a corrective to the light that Emerson speaks for, that I recognize in all of us.
Emerson said, you know, all his life he'd been teaching the infinitude of the private man. I keep coming back to that, but I think of others. I mean, Sonny Rollins for me is a voice inside my head. Duke Ellington for sure. Vijay Iyer, no relation to you, I don't believe, but a young Indian-American pianist who has found a connection to Thelonious Monk and is making a huge career. Are there musicians who play that role in our culture, in our heads?
I think all of us have many songs going around in our heads perpetually, and it's interesting how both the hymns that we have to learn at school sometimes or the songs we've learned at different stages in our life are embedded in our consciousness, the way words from books or, for most people, words from Emerson essays are not. I, for 40 years, have identified intensely with Leonard Cohen. And in fact, at one point, my recent book on Graham Greene had 10 pages about the correspondences between Graham Greene and Leonard Cohen and why I was drawn to these two figures who came to seem indistinguishable in my head, in their spiritual restlessness, their inability to make a home within a family, their determination to live outside categories, their mixture of worldliness and longing, their embrace of their fallenness even as they're still trying to become better people, their candor, unsparing candor about their most broken parts in themselves. And then finally, I decided to spare the reader those pages, so they're somewhere in a closet. But I've spent, since I was a teenager, I suppose, I've been listening to Leonard Cohen. I've spent a lot of time with him now in real life and visiting him in his monastery. And it's been wonderful to see so much of the world suddenly realize that there's this great wise man in our midst who is both an ordained Zen monk and a man of the world with all that connotes, and is able to hold those both simultaneously in his head. And another one of my favorite Emerson quotes, though you will remember it correctly and I will mangle it, but it's something about it's easy to keep... I will paraphrase it rather than mangle it. So I always feel it's easy to be calm and pure on the top of a mountain, and it's easy to be stimulated in the middle of Times Square. But the really great person is the one who can bring the clarity and calm and directedness of the mountain right into the thick of the madness of the world. And that's why I wrote about the Dalai Lama, and that's what Leonard Cohen offers, I think, that a monk in the middle of the world, carrying himself with humility and generosity and selflessness, and yet able to play the game in Hollywood and in the music industry and some of the less exalted sides of the modern moment.
Take us out on this matter of people, particularly for all sorts of other readers, women, black folk, anybody, who are going to read your book and sort of puzzle, wait a second, who's mine? Who's looking over my shoulder? Who's encouraging me? Who's warning me? Who's chiding me, etc.?
Yes, I love the note on which you just ended, because Graham Greene is a warning more than an illumination. Thoreau and Emerson in The American Way show me where I want to go. Greene is pointing to all the ditches and the cracks in the road along the way, and that point, those are really cracks in the self. And I love what you said about the infinitude of the private man, because that is what Emerson's subject, interiority, and really a kind of radiance that many, all of us have within. Greene is about the infinitude of the private man when it comes to numberless shadows and guilts and betrayals that we have inside us that we have to look at. Everywhere man longs to be settled, but only insofar as he's unsettled is there hope for him, I think Emerson said.
Thank you, Emerson.
And that could have been the epigraph for my book. In fact, while trying to figure out Graham Greene, I spent 8 years on this book, I drew up 60 quotations that I thought shed light on him. Most of them came from Melville, Emily Dickinson, Emerson, and Thoreau. When you ask many women, who's the person in their head? I think my book arose out of a very distinct memory that when I was growing up, every other woman I knew seemed almost unable to listen to Joni Mitchell because she felt as if Joni Mitchell had stolen her diary and released all her secrets to the world in albums such as Blue. And I remember one friend of mine in particular, I would come into her room and she was sitting on the ground, stubbing out a cigarette on the carpet. And over on the turntable, as it was in those days, would be playing A Case of You or Little Green, one of those rending Joni Mitchell songs about loneliness and love gone wrong and pregnancies with unhappy endings. As Sylvia Plath, it could be Emily Dickinson in all our heads. I spend more and more time with Emily Dickinson's work, and they're little explosives that send ripples all around my head, and I can't escape their force field. I mean, she's one of the most bodiless and terrifying presences around. And going right to the essence, because all she's writing about is light, God, death, doubt, perhaps. So, Sylvia Plath and others have always been, I think, very important for many women that I know. And we could come up with many for black folk also. But I think it's an interesting thing because these are people who are to some extent ruling or guiding our lives, and it's easy not to stop and think who they are. But I think it's tonic to attend to them because they have messages that are very different from the ones that our parents are giving. And we are shaping ourselves in their image often more than our parents. You know, one of the interesting things about Graham Greene is that when he was 16, he tried to run away from his school, partly because his father was the headmaster there. He failed, but his parents, with unusually enlightened attitudes for England in 1920, sent him to live for 6 months in London with a Jungian dream analyst.
I never knew that until your book. It's fascinating.
Yes.
And he half fell in love with the analyst's wife.
Yes, with the analyst's dangerously glamorous wife. And he would dream about the wife and then have to tell the analyst in the morning about the dreams he'd had. But I think that really formed him for the rest of his life. And he was always aware of this parallel universe, literally underground, story after story, even right up to the last novel he published when he was 84 years old, about a boy walking away from the official daylight upstanding world and into this underground ruled by a roguish, colorful, charming man and his mole. And that speaks almost for our souls, I would say. And Emerson would very much be the daylight self. But there is something else that has to do with the subconscious and dreams. And I love the way that Greene would dream of a ship going down in the Irish Sea, and then upon awaking here 4 days later, while he was dreaming, a ship had gone down in the Irish Sea, that if you attend closely enough to the subconscious, whether you're writing or dreaming, you see that it's actually prefiguring the future as much as the past.
Isn't it funny that Graham Greene and Henry James, in their sort of, in the net of it all, come back to kindness and compassion? Henry James's advice to his nephew was, be kind, be kind, be kind. And Graham Greene, in the end, is so concerned with individual gentleness.
I mean, that's one of the things I really cherish about Greene, which is that he put kindness before doctrine, I would say. What you do is more important than what you believe, fundamentally, or what you don't believe. I know Freeman Dyson, the great physicist, said some years ago, I'm a practicing but not a believing Christian, which certainly would apply to Greene, that the belief is often something in our heads and we can argue it every which way. But what do you do with the person right next to you who's starving or in need or whatever? And you remember the last time, well, the second to last time you and I spoke was about my previous book, which is the Dalai Lama. And I see a lot that the Dalai Lama and Graham Greene have in common as compassionate realists, both of them really looking at the world as it is, undiluted, without screens, and yet both of them seeing hope or possibility within it for us to act better than we imagine. And it's interesting that just last month, the Dalai Lama brought out his most recent book called Beyond Religion. So as the most visible Buddhist in the world, probably, first, when he comes to the U.S., he tells us, don't become Buddhists. Stay within your own traditions or lack of traditions, where your roots are deepest and where there's least danger of misunderstanding. But secondly, in this new book, he's saying you don't even need religion. The most fundamental thing is kindness and responsibility to the people around you. And he says religion is a luxury, but the necessity is just that everyday kindness. And he says it's like the difference between water and tea. We all need water to survive. If we have the tea bag that is religion, that's wonderful. Then life has extra savor and dimension. But if you don't have that opportunity, at least attend to putting water into your system. So I see the book, The Man Within My Head, about Graham Greene, is almost a sequel to the previous book I wrote about the Dalai Lama. In fact, suddenly struck me 4 days ago, I could have called the book about the Dalai Lama The Man Within My Head, and I could have called the Greene book The Open Road, that it's really just part of one inquiry. And it is the Emerson inquiry, too, because in a different way he was talking about that. But I think Emerson and Thoreau are more about retrieving the potential within us. And Graham Greene and the Dalai Lama are a lot about responsibility to others and our debts to the people who are dependent on us.
You brought it full circle. Pico Iyer, it's such a joy always to talk with you. Up with the men in all of our heads, and especially the men in yours. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.